The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 25th of April, 2019. On the podcast today, I have David Ciclatira, Executive Chairman of Live Company Group, LVCG, sticker there. And David talks about the launch of Brick Live Ocean at Edinburgh Zoo, and covers other parts of the business too. Also on the podcast, Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish, D-I-S-H, and Aidan provides an update on their expansion into further territories across the UK. And Graham Swindles, Chief Executive Officer of Clough Natural Resources, CLNR, and Graham goes through some of the highlights for the year in line with the release of their preliminary results today. Plus, I also have Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covering news from Sainsbury's, Nasdaq, of course, that doomed merger, Barclays, and Taylor Wimpey. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see these right now on the front page of Vox, voxmarkets.co.uk. We've got the morning note from SP Angel, twin risks to hit Chinese steel sector. We've also got an article on Predator Oil and Gas. Plus, there's a video from one of my guests today, Chris Bailey. I do mention that in the podcast. And he talks about his background in hedge fund management and stuff. Plus, there's a Malky blog. There's lots of stuff there. That's voxmarkets.co.uk.
Are you tired of missing news about stock market companies you follow? The Vox Markets app helps investors stay ahead by making sure you never miss an important update. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Ciclatira, Executive Chairman of Live Company Group. LVCG is a ticker there. David, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much. Good to speak to you again.
Yeah, you too. And you're always busy. You've announced the launch of Brick Live Ocean in Edinburgh Zoo. And we'll get into the detail of that. And I've almost lost count of the amount of shows you're in now. We'll catch that figure up, hopefully, in a bit. Before we do, if someone's listening right now, David, and they've never heard of the company, they're new to investing, new to podcasting, and explain, summarise, what's the company all about, please?
The company owns all the rights to a brand called Brick Live. Brick Live is a global brand associated. It's an entertainment and education brand linked to bricks. And it has interactive shows. And basically, that's really the main thrust of the company.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what? Where I live, down in the South Coast, I've seen quite a few posters around already for the local zoo here, Marwell Zoo, because you're going there.
Well, and funny you should speak about Marwell. If you went to Marwell now, you'd find Brickosaurus, which is our newest, prior to the Ocean announced today, our newest show based around dinosaurs, 90 dinosaurs. Just had a cracking weekend over Easter. It's there until September. It's a really amazing show.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I mean, the advertising is very eye-catching. My kids have seen it. They've seen that. I said, look at that. And I explained, who that is. And we obviously came to Birmingham to see the show there. But they're very impressed with that. So let's get into this, the latest bit of news then. Launch of Brick Live Ocean in Edinburgh Zoo. Take us into the detail here, if you could, David.
It's if you may remember, we raised some money at the beginning of the year from our existing shareholders, including myself, so that we could fast-track new builds. This is the first of those new builds. It's a tour based on ocean animals, 30 pieces. Its first outing will be at Edinburgh Zoo. It's booked to go to Geneva, for example, in October. It's going to the Monaco show over Christmas and lots of other places between then and now. It's a thematical show. We've been working, as you know, we're now working with many zoos. Edinburgh Zoo is a new zoo to us, and I think they're very happy with the agreement, as we are. It's a very good relationship that's been built there.
Yeah, and I don't know what's out there in the public domain, the financials and the margins about these, but I assume these are profitable shows for you, are they?
Well, basically, how it works is that we create the content, we provide the content. So the things you're seeing down in Marwell, for example, Edinburgh is exactly the same. We provide it. They are renting that content for a period of time. And the obviously, the margins work for both parties. I think the key for the zoos, on average, the zoos have seen a 30% increase on attendance based on the shows that we put in there. So that obviously works well for them, and obviously it works well for us.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we've just touched on obviously parts of the UK, but if someone, like I said, is new to the podcast right now, it's worth saying you are international, aren't you?
Yes. We've got, for example, two shows going on as we speak in Germany, one in Cologne, one in Duisburg. We'll have shows going on later this year in France and in Switzerland. We have shows going on in China. We have 8 shows this year in Japan. We're in Korea. We're in Thailand. We're in South America. And, of course, we've just been in the United States, and we'll be looking to run new shows in the fall this year in the United States. So it's a global brand, all based around the brand Brick Live. I think it obviously started with one show. The founding show is the show at the NEC, which is going to be the end of October this year, over half term. That's probably the biggest show that we run. It's 16,000 square meters. There are exhibitions of around 4,000 square meters. And then there are these tours, which are not so much exhibitions, but they're basically tours, and they're in zoos, and we expect to be in 20 zoos next year. There's interest now in zoos. We're launching a zoo in Chicago in 10 days' time, actually. And we've now got discussions as far away as Australia and Asia for zoos there. So it's pretty much you can see Brick Live in many places.
Yeah, well, I didn't ask you, so I've lost track. So how many have you done this year? How many are you hoping to do?
Well, I think if you look at our website, you'll find that there's a calendar online, which gets a, as part of a newsletter, that we have a monthly newsletter. So if your listeners want to basically look at our live company website, you'll go into the latest edition of the newsletter. There's a calendar of events that gets updated every month. So we're expecting to be in 60 plus by the end of the year, but it's currently, I think, 38, 39. But anyway, all the details are on the website, something that many people have asked for, and we've now finally got it up there, and it's updated every month. So marvelous. That gives you the answers to all of your listeners.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at it now. Some impressive pictures. I assume that's in the US, the big Ford Center. Is that right?
Yeah, that was in Dallas. That was actually a partnership with the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, that's it.
So it's an in-house, sort of the training ground there that they have. But you'll also see on there, I think, the posters or the images that your children would have seen of the T-Rex, which is obviously full size and fairly dramatic. So that's obviously something that's tremendous. There's a very large whale in the Brick Live Ocean. So these are all made, obviously, of Lego bricks. They are amazing creations, and I think bring to life for children the various animals.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, David. Well, 3 things I'm going to ask you for right now. So if someone's listening right now and likes the sound of what you're doing but are not yet following the story, just give them 3 quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think we're global. That's obviously important. We own our own brand. So we're not licensing Brick Live from anybody. We're licensing Brick Live to other people. Very crucial. So there's a strong value for the brand. We're also a profitable business with strong growth potential.
Excellent stuff, David. And like you said, you are a big shareholder as well, so you're aligned with other shareholders, I suppose.
Well, I'm just depending on what time of the day it is, it's 40% of the shares. And I'm very, very excited about this company. What I'm most interested in is we're now really beginning to perform as a business. When we first started, it was a matter of getting away from one show and building show after show. In revenue terms this year, we're 56% already reached, and in our touring shows and assets, we're over 100% of our budget already in April. So I'm very excited about the potential for this company, and I think we've got a long way to go, but we're doing well.
Excellent stuff. Excellent. David, good to chat to you. And like I say, lots going on, so no doubt we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish. D-I-S-H is the ticker there. Aidan, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
Now, you've announced some expansion updates, and before we get into that, let's talk about what the company's about. Quick summary, if people are listening and they haven't heard of Big Dish, explain it to them if you could, Aidan.
Big Dish is all about providing a smarter dining experience. Dine smarter is one of our hashtags, and what that simply means is that people can book a table up to 48 hours in advance on the Big Dish platform, and every seat has a discount associated with it. Now, from the restaurant side, it becomes a platform where they can add excess inventory, i.e. empty tables, to the Big Dish platform, particularly in quieter or off-peak times, and use the Big Dish platform to market those tables to consumers.
Yeah. And I like that hashtag, really, Dine Smarter, because it can also suggest just dressing up a bit as well. just make yourself look a bit smarter. But Dine Smarter is intellectually and, of course, physically as well. Why not? So these expansion updates, tell us where you are at the moment, and also tell us where these expansion updates where this expansion is going, please.
Well, we're in two territories, Territory 1 and Territory 2. They're in the southwest of the UK. If you look at recent announcements, we've been talking about building this launch pad, and it's pretty much getting to completion, I have to say, and getting ready to push the button on a nationwide sort of expansion as a thrust. But we've announced today, and within our Territory 1, we are adding Basingstoke, and within Territory 2, we are adding Exeter. So that will give us Bristol, Bath, Exeter, Bournemouth, Southampton, Basingstoke, and we're also announced that Territory 3 will open up in May, and that will be Brighton, beginning with Brighton.
Cool. How fast and how far are you going to roll out then? I mean, where are you going to end up? Hopefully.
Well, I mean, a lot of people are trying to speculate on that. I mean, some people are, think that we should be just going full blast right now. But you've got to build the platform. You've got to build this launch pad to be able to do it correctly. I mean, we want to go all over the UK. We want to do it as a single initiative. And we're getting close to being able to push that button and to be able to do that. How fast we will do it is really dependent upon the ability to, or the speed of being able to recruit territory managers in each of the territories. So we've broken down the UK into 10 territories. London is sort of considered sort of three. So we're in two territories, about to expand into a third. And yeah, so we're going to have to recruit about another 8, 9, 10 persons.
Yeah, okay. When I first heard about this, I thought, I've said to you before, it seems like a no-brainer for both parties. The consumer, it costs them nothing just to check their app to see if they can get 20, 30, 50% off. And for the restaurateur who has empty seats to fill, it's best to get some money going through the tills rather than just sitting there doing nothing. But of course, I mean, when it comes to ideas, you've got to have a proof of concept. So where's this? I mean, is this operated around the world anywhere else? Is there a proof of concept elsewhere?
Yes, I mean, so first of all, what yield management is all about contributing towards the overheads. So a restaurant has fixed overheads. It has rent, it has staff, it has food costs, it has power, water. All of these things are fixed costs. So what yield management is about is basically revenue management and being able to contribute to fixed costs. Otherwise, those tables remain empty and they generate no money. So who's doing this around the world? Well, I first saw this being done by a company called Savored in New York in 2012. They were probably the world's first to do this. And Savored was bought by Groupon. And they were, Groupon obviously saw them as a threat to their daily deals model in New York, and they bought them and at a very early stage, and then they closed them down. So, which is quite common sometimes with tech companies when they buy companies that are, they see as a threat. If they don't absorb it into the business, they might absorb components into it, and then they sort of shut it down. So the other company that's doing this is TripAdvisor, of course. So TripAdvisor invested into a company in Asia, $20 million so far they've invested into that company, and they're in several Asian countries. And they first started investing, I believe it was 2015. It might have, 2015 or 16, somewhere around there. So, you know, so several years, you've got a giant like TripAdvisor that's made a bet on the on yield management disrupting the restaurant industry. So, you know, it's a good benchmark.
Yeah, and you've got a sort of connection with TripAdvisor as well, haven't you?
Well, not me personally. Of course, our CEO, Sanj, worked at TripAdvisor. Mm-hmm. And Sanj's background prior to TripAdvisor, was with Booker Table, and he was brought in at a time when I think Booker Table had about 100 restaurants, pretty similar to what we've got now, although I think we've got slightly more. And his remit was to bring in groups and so forth for Booker Table, and they grew that to, I don't know, I think it was 4,000 or 5,000 restaurants in quite a quick space of time. And then at TripAdvisor, he ran, it was global B2B sales and marketing. And the remit there was to grow the restaurant numbers from 11,000, and they did that, took them to about over 35,000 restaurants in the space of about 2 years. So Sanj is quite well known to the TripAdvisor guys and another of the other companies that operate in restaurant tech. So, yeah, looks good.
Marvelous stuff. Okay, well, Aidan, as you know, you've been on before, so if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing but are not following the story as yet, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on the page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
One great reason to follow Big Dish is if you're in the UK, we're going to be coming to an area near you at some point in our expansion. So, look, if you like to eat out, if you like a deal, follow Big Dish.
Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I mean, I always speak to CEOs, founders, and I know founders always have a skin in the game, but you have a skin in the game as well, don't you? Which, as an investor, I always look for. So, I mean, you are behind the project, aren't you?
Yeah, look, nobody wants this to succeed more than I do. I'm a company's largest shareholder, so nobody wants it to succeed more than I do.
Well, that's a huge motivational factor, though, I find, when I'm, for an investor, because if you are behind it, exactly, you'll work your backside off to get it working, which I like. And
Absolutely. I mean, why would anybody invest in a company where the management didn't have skin in the game? It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. Marvellous. Aidan, good to chat to you, and hopefully you'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. All right?
Great. Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Graham Swindells, Chief Executive Officer of Clough Natural Resources, CLNR, a sticker there. Graham, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure, Justin.
Now, you've had your preliminary results out, and in that you say it's been a transformational year for the company, and we'll go through the reasons why and also what's to come, hopefully, in the rest of this year. But before we do, Graham, as always, if someone is listening right now and I've never heard of Clough Natural Resources, can you explain what you're about, please?
Sure. Clough is an AIM-quoted natural resources investment company. Our primary focus is on exploration and appraisal, and we've developed a portfolio focused on the southern and central North Sea, and most recently have partnered with Shell on one and possibly two of our licenses.
Excellent stuff, yes. Well, that's part of the news of why it's been transformational. So, take us through some of the highlights, Graham, you've achieved this year, and also then after that we'll touch on what your hopes to come.
Sure. Well, look, I think it's it wouldn't be an understatement to say that the last year has been truly transformational for the company. Think back to this time last year, we simply had two licenses and we were looking for farm out partners. We now have seven licenses, a diversified portfolio of both gas and oil licenses in the central and the southern North Sea. We have a super major partner in the form of Shell, and we've secured a farm out over one, what we hope will be a further license on our portfolio. So we now effectively have line of sight over the drilling of at least one, if not two, wells in the next year or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that really is, you know, having a partner like Shell for a small oil and gas exploration company is the holy grail, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. We couldn't have hoped for a better partner than Shell. You know, in terms of size, certainly, you know, we are the first company that they have farmed into, certainly in the southern North Sea for a great many years. So we're very proud of that achievement, and we are, you know, now developing that relationship and partnership and looking ahead and certainly we and they see this as just the start of what we hope will be a very long and fruitful relationship going forward.
Okay, excellent. Well, going forward, Graham, take us through the next sort of few milestones you're hoping to achieve, if you could.
Okay, well, we expect significant activity and news flow over the coming months and the rest of the year. In particular, in an order, we expect to hear from Shell in relation to the option over the Selene prospect, which we will hopefully hear on within the next week or so. We'll be announcing the completion of the Pensacola farm out very shortly. The seismic acquisition will be commencing on the Pensacola prospect in the course of the summer. We will be commencing the farm-out process on our Dure oil prospect, which is license 2352, which we announced this morning, that our revised estimate of oil on that prospect is up to 270 million barrels of oil in place and a P50 of just under 40 million barrels of oil equivalent. In the meantime, we will be applying for additional licenses in the UK's next 32nd licensing round, and hopefully working towards making a well investment decision on the Selene prospect. So quite significant news flow over the near and the long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's it like at the moment, oil and gas? What's your thoughts? What's sentiment like within the industry?
The sentiment in the industry is continuing to improve. I think there are a number of factors supporting that. I mean, I suppose the most obvious one is not so much higher commodity prices, but more than anything, far more stable commodity prices, and obviously at this higher level. I think the UK has improved quite significantly in terms of its fiscal and regulatory regime. Costs have come down, you know, quite dramatically through the downturn. And as a result of that, I think there's no better time to be drilling in the North Sea than now. And we've seen that with the level of activity, renewed interest from majors, and in particular the private equity guys who have come in quite significant numbers.
Yeah, it's amazing how sentiment changes, isn't it? You know, because I remember going back a few years now when the oil price took a massive dip there. You know, the gloom mongers were out. But then, you know, you realise it's very cyclical. And when you see that, you can almost guarantee it's going to bounce back up, can't you?
I know, exactly. But I think it's a credit to the industry, and there were a lot of people that a few years back had more or less written off the North Sea as a mature basin that had seen its best days. But I think we are seeing certainly a changing of the guard, but certainly no shortage of activity and interest, and certainly it's become certainly one of the most attractive places to invest, even on a global basis.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, well, Graham, if someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're talking about and the progress you're making here but are not following the story as yet, could you give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please?
Sure. Well, we've got a very well diversified portfolio of 7 licenses in both gas and oil now, and we anticipate being able to further expand that with applications in the next licensing round, which is due to open up this year. We've got a super major partner in the form of Shell, and we now have line of sight over drilling of at least one, if not 2 wells in the next year to 2 years. We remain relatively low cost and agile, and we have a great portfolio of assets and prospects going forward.
Marvellous stuff. Graham, good to chat to you. And like you say, lots of things happening in the not-too-distant future, so hopefully we'll catch up very soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Very good. Thank you. Very good.
And I learned a bit more about you this week because I've been watching the video you did with Abraham at Vox Markets. Oh, very interesting background,
right?
You've got
yes.
There. Yeah, and, I didn't know all that about you, and I know you're a sharp cookie when it comes to looking at companies and balance sheets and cash flow and all this stuff and investing. I didn't know that much, but so I'd say it's worth checking out right now on the front page of Vox Markets. You'll see a video interview with Chris and his career, and very interesting it is. But talking about stuff, talking about big stuff. Go on.
I was going to say, I reckon it should have been an audio, not a video interview, because you've unfortunately got to look at me as well, albeit sort of with headphones on and various other bits of paraphernalia in front of us. But turn the video bit off and just listen to the words. I reckon.
Listen, I've seen a lot worse, Chris. Don't worry about that. anyway, listen. Let's get on to the news, and I suppose what's dominating it there, dominating, but certainly hitting the headlines here. Is Sainsbury's Asda.
That's right.
What's
that?
Right.
Look, number one headline, I guess, is going to be that the deal's fallen apart. The Competition and Markets Authority have said basically no go, or despite Sainsbury's clear efforts to try to get it through in terms of divesting stores, they're just too worried about the fact that you put Asda and Sainsbury's together, it's well over 30% of the market, and they're obsessed with big market concentrations, and that's why they don't like it. Personally, I think it's the wrong decision, and I say that because I think the food retail market's changing, and changing very quickly, be it online delivery, be it new competitors, German discounters and the like, and everything else. But you know, they've made their decision and it is what it is. You know, it is binding. So Sainsbury's shares is kind of interesting because obviously people thought this was a potential option. They have been under pressure for the last few months. But take a look at the chart. And I looked at the 3- and 5-year chart just a few minutes ago. And it's absolutely fascinating because the share is now right at that sort of support level that we've seen the shares bounce off multiple times over the last 3 or 5 years. So big old level for Sainsbury's shares. But you have to say no corporate strategy at all because, you know, the thing they've been concentrating on, that they've been wanting to do, has just been blown out the water. So in a fast moving market, I have to say probably prudence is the best thing, best strategy here. There's no need to dive in. Just I would wait for the next set of numbers, see how the share gets on, but I am observing it at these big support levels. So you know, I think for technical and fundamental analysts, there's something of kind of interest to monitor and watch here.
Yeah, it's funny. Do you know what? I'm kind of for it because I just think that you're right. You know, competition is increasing in the market. You know, you've got the Germans of low costers. They're increasing slowly but surely their market share and this diverse range of opportunities. But I heard something. In fact, I'm looking at the Sainsbury CEO, Mike Coop, what he said today. He says the specific reason for wanting to merge was to lower prices for customers. And he said the Competition and Markets Authority that we would increase post-merger ignores dynamic and highly competitive nature of the UK grocery market. The CMA, this is quite a hard line here, the CMA today is effectively taking £1 billion out of customers' pockets. Now, you know, the thing is, I was listening to Radio 5 Live this morning, and a guy sent a text in saying, I shop at Asda. He said, and I put this in simple terms, he said, I shop at Asda, and I can get a multi-pack of Diet Coke, he said, I think it's like three, I don't know what the numbers were, but he said, about £3. Now, in Sainsbury's, they're £4. Don't tell me they're not going to meet in the middle. I thought, well, you know, he's got a point to a certain extent.
Absolutely. I guess the company would say, look, we're going to get sourcing synergies and all of that. But, you know, there is certainly the potential. how it was going to work in reality was a good debate, because you know, Sainsbury's is that sort of middle class aspirational kind of shop, broadly speaking. Asda is pitched a little bit lower down the social strata on average. You know, that doesn't mean they don't attract ABC One customers or other types of customers or whatever, but you know, that's the way they're broadly set up. So how they were going to merge that into one group was going to be fascinating to watch, but they're not going to get the opportunity. And I agree, I think it's the wrong decision. I think actually in reality you will see further consolidation in food retail in the UK at some point over the next 5 or so years. My feeling would be they won't try and do this one again. They'll be too sensitive towards that. Maybe something like a Morrison's, Asda, you know, two northern powerhouse sort of companies, maybe they might consider merging or something.
Yeah, okay, marvellous. Sainsbury's, as I look, was down 5%. I was just coming back a little bit. But
that's right. I say check out the 3 and 5 year chart. You'll see what I mean about the support levels. You know, it's big levels here, but you know, they've spent so, I can't reiterate how much time they've spent on this deal. Yeah. So this is going to be absolutely galling in Sainsbury's headquarters this morning.
Yeah. But thing is, why don't they just say, what are the competition markets are saying? Well, if it's good for the consumer, let's let it go ahead. And if you don't meet certain criteria within 3 years, you could be fined billions. And then just carry on like that. I mean, and then all of a sudden, or they have to and lower their prices or whatever. So, you know, I think it's a way, constructive way forward, isn't it? Rather than just saying blocking it, you know? Let the market play out. Let's see what happens here, you know?
That's right. Well, I'm a great believer in the market mechanism kicking in. And as I say, I think that the fear about too much market share is going to be overrun by competition, online, and other evolutions to our food retail experience. So, yeah, I think they're fighting yesterday's war, basically.
Exactly. Amazon's coming in, all that stuff. And yeah, exactly. So, okay, what are the news out there, Chris?
So that Sainsbury's, Barclays has had its numbers out today. Obviously, huge bank, being very controversial in recent months. The activist investor, a guy called Edward Bransom, sort of US activist investor, has been on the shareholder register, been agitating for a board seat, hasn't got it. He said that basically the investment bank part of Barclays has been underperforming. Edward Bransom.
He's got a bit of money, is he? God, if he's...
He's got a sort of investment vehicle called Sherborne, I think it's called, and he's picked up a stake in the company in Barclays, agitating for a board seat. He said, look, Barclays structure is wrong. It's got investment bank, it's got retail bank, it's got corporate bank, but they need to do less investment banking. The retail and other parts of the business are all right. The investment bank's under pressure. Actually, today's numbers look as if they're very much akin to his criticisms. Investment bank disappointed a bit. The rest of the business did all right. They reiterated all their targets for the full year, so it wasn't a complete washout. But, you know, again, it sort of shows that, to me, that there is still, I would say, good value in UK banks, but there's just no faith whatsoever. You know, banking is a confidence game. And let's face it, when you've got things like Brexit and whatever still uncertainly lingering in all around about, people aren't going to be picking up the banks aggressively. So you've got Barclays trading on 0.6 tangible book. They've reiterated they're going to produce a 10% return on tangible equity next year, which sounds like a lot of geek mathematics, but basically what it's telling you is that Barclays is a cheap stock. It's got a 4% yield, but nobody believes at the moment. And the activist, I think, will just redouble his efforts to get the board in his mind to see sense, or at least appoint him to the board, so he can argue the toss sort of in-house rather than outside. So my feeling is Barclays is quite interesting here. It's got a 4% plus yield. It's superficially a cheap share, and I think if you get a bit of, all you need is Brexit clarity and the hope that the UK is not completely going over the cliff edge or something. Then I think financial shares will bounce a bit in the UK. Barclays looks cheap in that regard. I personally own the share. I think it is cheap. I think the activist has some valid criticisms, but actually the bigger reality is that the share should be £2. And on that basis, the activist breaks even, and perhaps he sort of with a less embarrassed red face kind of goes a bit quieter at that point.
You know what? Just reading up on Is he from the UK? Apparently he left the UK when it was under Labour in the doldrums back in the 80s.
That's right.
And but he's, you know, he's done this with a lot of British companies, hasn't he? And he said he's a US-based investor who admits that some people would describe him as pond scum. But he notched up 5.2% shareholding in Barclays. So he's agitating there, but it's not the first time he's done this. But
no, that's right. That's right. No, he was
interesting guy.
Yeah, no, F&C was the other famous one in the UK sort of financial space. You may remember F&C Foreign and Colonial.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a big old activist attack there, which where he thought there was hidden value and possibilities, and you know ultimately that kind of worked out all right. You know, he did have some valid points. So he's a guy with credit. Ability, but this is obviously a bigger tier issue, and so far the Barclays board are not playing ball. So my feeling is today's numbers just adds a little bit more pressure onto the board. They're doing all right, but they're not hitting the ball out of the park. And until they do that, the activist is going to, I think, have some valid pressure on things like cost control, which has been good, plus, you know, thinking about, okay, on the investment bank, should it really be as much for focus going forward? I think if they make it slightly less for focus, they run the business a bit more for cash. As I say, you've got value there. So I would still say Barclays shares are cheap.
Yeah, he was born in Paddington, but emigrated to New York in 1975 because of Labour and the unions and all that stuff. But he's obviously done quite well for himself, yeah. Marvellous, but he apparently doesn't do much many interviews, but he said, yeah, people would call him a pond scum. But I quite like the fact that, you know, when you take a seat there and agitate a bit, because I think all boards, you know, boards can become complacent, can't they? You know, they're paid a pretty penny,
and
they can easily become complacent, and no one really challenging them. So it's nice to know that they can't just sit there and do nothing and just crack on. They've got to do something. Cool. What's anything else, Chris?
The final one's got to be Taylor Wimpey in the house building sector. AGM today at Taylor Wimpey, but they've come out with a little pre-AGM statement, which, you know, seemed at first glance an all right statement. They're talking about, you know, the market, the housing market being okay, kind of workable. But going to the detail, they've said that they're seeing higher input prices, and this is obviously going to have a bit of an impact, particularly in the first half of the year. And I think this has led to a bit of a sector-wide sell-off today. Most sector shares are down a number of percent. And, you know, higher input costs, this is at multiple levels, I would say. Maybe it's a little bit of skill shortages on some of their workers. Maybe it's on things like bricks, where I think there's a bit of pricing power in the industry. But also I think it's because they're having to spend a bit more money on making sure that their homes, the houses that they build, are actually of a decent quality. And you recall a lot of the criticism of recent months that lots of the new builds, particularly from companies such as Persimmon's, really caught the flak. But Taylor Wimpey hasn't been hasn't been impacted, but has been impacted by this. The build quality has been poor or shabby. People have had lots of sort of fixes after they've moved in, etc. And the government obviously has got a bit hacked off by this, particularly as they've got things like the Help to Buy policy, which has underwritten house builder profitability for the last few years. You know, 50-odd percent of Taylor Wimpey's profits come from Help to Buy. So if the government's not getting the sort of the good quality houses they hoped for from it, from this scheme, quite rightly they're putting pressure on the house builders. Net-net, I think a lot of this talk about higher input costs is actually the house builders saying we've got to upscale our efforts a little bit to make sure that we don't hack the government off sufficiently, that they pull Help to Buy and suddenly half our profits are under pressure. So, you know, by hook or by crook, profits are under a bit of pressure here, be it through regulatory change or be it through higher input costs. And obviously with the still uncertain property market, or at least expensive property market versus incomes, not surprised to see these shares under a bit of pressure today. And it isn't a sector I like, to be honest. So kind of not too surprised to see the comments today.
Did you say it isn't in a sector, or it is in a sector you like?
It isn't a sector I like. I can make a case on demand supply and the fact that UK centred shares in sort of a bit of Brexit clarity situation could get a bit of a bid. However, I think this is overrun or overwhelmed, if you like, by the fact that property prices are high. Help to Buy doesn't look as a slam dunk, a sort of a continuing regulatory kind of legislative help to the sector that it has been for the last few years. I'd say they're under pressure there, and you've got things around the margin such as high higher input costs and lower margins, which are also impacting. You put it all into the mixer, I would not be holding the house builders stroke property stocks here. So I'm not surprised to see today's move. And, you know, a reiteration really of the fact this is a sector to be avoided, despite what appears to be lowish valuations and good dividend yields. I wouldn't be chasing this sector. And I'm not involved.
Marvellous. Good stuff. Anything else, Chris? Is that it for today? That's obviously there's plenty to go on, but
more than enough. Thousand and one earnings out there globally at the moment. So way too busy. But there are a few ones that caught my attention in the UK.
Cool, marvelous stuff, Chris. Speak next week, fella.
Sounds a plan. See you soon.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five: Integumin. That is SKIN skin, of course. Released some news today. At four, Live Company Group. Of course, I had David on the podcast talking about the Edinburgh show. At three, Block Energy, BLOE. At two, Nuformix, NFX. And the number one, in fact, I'll just refresh the page there. It's changed. It's gone to Diurnal as number two, plus Block down to three. It's Diurnal Group, DNL is ticker there. And number one most followed company is Canadian Overseas Petroleum, down 7%. It's a high-risk strategy, but people are steadily following it. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows: Anglo-African Oil and Gas, CPR update and cost reimbursements. At four, Spain Winter, work program results. What was this from? It's from Metal Tiger. They never have their name in the title, so which is quite annoying. But let's see, Metal Tiger there, where's the scroll down? Sorry, I do apologise. Spain Winter Work Programme Update and Drill Results. And for Anglo-African CPR, oh, it's changed. See, it's dynamic, the page. Go to Vox Markets, okay, you see the change there. You refresh the page, also things are liked and they move around. So at three, Big Dish Expansion Updates. I chat to Aidan, of course, about that. At two, Predator Oil and Gas, Grief Permit, Competent Persons Report. And at number one is Sirius Minerals, Major European Supply and Distribution Agreement. That's SXX, of course. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.